Why don't I open us in prayer first, and we'll go to the Lord. Father, as we approach you in this moment, we desire to honor you in all that we do. We desire to honor you in our lives, in our hearts, in our ministries, and even in the way that we approach our school. I, as a professor, desire to honor you in my teaching, and I am sure that these students desire to honor you in the way they study. And Lord, in the midst of this, we ask that as you are glorified in us, that you would also teach us and prepare us for our future ministries, that we might bring further glory to you, even in years and decades ahead, as we're better able and prepared to minister your word to others. I ask that you use this class to that end, in the name of our dear Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen. Are there any questions about the midterm, in terms of now that you've had a chance to look at the study guide? I'm happy to interact with those questions for about 5 minutes here. Yeah. If you were a slave, you would, depending on your owner, it's really at your owner's will, and some of this could be negotiated ahead of time if you were seeking to become somebody's slave, but the owner has the right to free you, and many owners would boast of having done so, and then you would change your status to that of a freed person. And once you're a freed person, you continue in a relationship with your former owner, usually in the form of a patron-client relationship, where they seek to look after you and you become their client, and so you have responsibilities to them as well. That is not the only way of entering into a patron-client relationship, especially among the upper classes of society. They wouldn't have done this. They would have simply negotiated some sort of patron-client interaction. But that was one way of becoming, participating in that patron-client thing. Yeah.
Thanks.
Other questions? Yes. That is, it's oriented around particular themes of rabbinic teaching. It finds its earliest expression in the Mishnah in AD 200. There are then three works that come out of that. The Tosefta follows the same structure as the Mishnah, but includes some other material. Tosefta means additions, roughly speaking, in Hebrew. And then the two Talmuds, the Jerusalem and the Babylonian Talmud, go back to the Mishnah itself, cite it, and then add additional rabbinic stories and debates that are connected topically with what is said in the Mishnah. Okay, and then Midrashic is commentaries. So they might actually cover the same sort of legal ground, same legal material, but instead of following a topical structure, they follow the structure of the biblical text, such as Deuteronomy or Exodus. Yeah. The Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23, I think there were about three things that I highlighted there. The Hebrew literally says, a sin bearing a judgment of death, if there is in a man a sin bearing a judgment of death. So what is the nature of that sin? The next controversy has to do with whether suspension is required and whether the person is dead before being suspended. That has to do with the sequence of verbs in verse 22. And then in verse 23, the major question is, what is the curse of God? Is it that the person's been cursed by God, or is it that in some way they've cursed God, either by being a blasphemer or by being in his image and being suspended? Is that good?
The Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
The Ptolemies and the Seleucids. You should know what region they were in, that the Ptolemies were in Egypt and that the Seleucids were in Persia, basically. That they followed on the heels of Alexander, that they are part of the diadochoi of his successors. And that Antiochus Epiphanes was a Seleucid. That's probably enough. Yes, the lesson 9, historical accuracy of the trial of Jesus, we will get to today. I've given you a very full set of notes, and I'm basically going to spend about 5 minutes on it and then just expect you to read the notes. I'm hoping that by the end of the day, all these questions are possible. If they're not, then I will go and revise the exam. I wrote it last night. There are about 20 multiple choice questions and about 8 short answer questions. That's what it comes down to. The text cohere. The idea is that, what does the deconstructionist do? The deconstructionist says that the text, any text, contains gaps that the author expects you to fill in, or that you normally fill in, is probably the way they would put it, as you read a text. And you fill in those gaps based on societal conventions. That if they instead challenge the societal conventions and insert different material into those gaps, that you can make the text fall apart, and that the text therefore no longer coheres. So that's what I meant by coheres. And so the question that I'm asking you is, how would you respond to that? How would you argue that, in point of fact, you can read a text and assume that there is a meaning that constitutes what the text is really about? With regarding the canon, I'm interested in kind of the main points to come out of that. So in Josephus mentions, I believe, is it 22 books, and says that we accept these as canonical, that the reason that although we've had history after the fact, that there's not a verified line of prophets, succession of prophets coming out of that, and so we don't esteem those books of like accord. So you know, with that, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. I mean, so 2 or 3 quick points about what they had to say. Yeah. And with Eusebius in particular, we asked, remember we did this kind of exercise where you guys got in groups and we asked, what does Eusebius signal as his concerns in terms of something being canonical or not? And that's what I'm interested in. Yeah, we listed a number of things. I don't remember the exact number, but yeah, that's right. He doesn't specifically refer to the book of Hebrews, I don't think, does he?
He just says, some have also counted the gospel according to Hebrews.
Oh, no, that's different. The gospel according to Hebrews is not the book of Hebrews.
Okay?
It's a separate lost... Hold on. It's a separate lost gospel that was known to have been circulated in the first century, and principally is known among Jewish Christian groups, which is why it's called the Gospel according to the Hebrews. It's the Jewish Christian Gospel. And we have some fragments of it recorded in other authors, but it is not the same as the book of Hebrews. He likely included the book of Hebrews among the Pauline epistles. Eusebius did, that is. Yes. Why is it worth studying the history of interpretation? Yeah. Why is it that you should know the history of any discipline is part of it, but what facets of the history of New Testament interpretation still affect the way that the New Testament is studied today by scholars, and even when they're writing lay material, the way that they answer questions? So a major example today is we're going to talk about the historical Jesus. Well, knowing something about the historical Jesus movement explains why Newsweek every year, you know, cranks out another article on who Jesus is. So that's the idea. Because knowing the history of the discipline helps you understand why certain questions are still out there and why people keep interacting with them. Yeah. Good. Is that good? Okay. Other things? At the end of the semester, I'll ask you to say how much you've read. That's good. Give me a rough percentage at the end of the semester. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's use that as a transition into our discussion of the historical Jesus. Pass this around. Okay. At the end of last time, I believe I mentioned that historical Jesus scholarship goes back at least a couple hundred years. And it arises out of certain questions that that were prevalent in their day and remain important. It arises out of the notion, for instance, that we are modern human beings, modern men and women, right? And modern men and women know that miracles don't happen. And so any historical work from antiquity that talks about miracles must be viewed with a certain degree of skepticism. Now, frankly, this wasn't just kind of abstract and out of the blue suddenly applied to the New Testament. In some ways, it's the byproduct of the Reformation and kind of the skepticism of the Renaissance into the Enlightenment. Because what happened was, all you have to do is read somebody like Erasmus. Erasmus tells the story of all the different places you could go to in Europe in his day to venerate the saints, and how all of them seemed to have a bit of wood from the cross. And he says that if you collected together all the wood of a cross, you could build an entire house. You know, I mean, he uses an analogy like that in any case. But his point is that there's so much stuff out there that is claimed to be holy and to be relics and to be associated with particular miracles that the saints performed on people's behalf, that naturally there arose kind of a skepticism as people moved into a more modern scientific worldview. It was just a small step from that to then turn to the New Testament and say, well, there's a lot of miracles and stuff going on here too. So what's up with that? There was also this issue, I think I might have mentioned, second class or so that we got together. Did I mention the Donation of Constantine? And the Donation of Constantine being this church document that was used to vouchsafe the importance of the papacy and of the Roman Catholic Church in light of this great Emperor Constantine. The document was shown to be a forgery written several centuries later, and yet this was an important document that had been much touted in the Catholic Church. Again, this ties into kind of the Renaissance, the Enlightenment. The flames were fanned as well in the Reformation as people began to look again at the Catholic Church and say, there are these foundational documents that are being employed that are not accurate. And then it's a small step from that to look at the Gospels and ask the same questions. Are these historically accurate and responsible accounts? And the initial responses were yes, and the initial responses with regard to the miracles were yes, we believe these miracles. But over time, the kind of increasing modernist skepticism came to be applied to the New Testament. That's, 200 years ago. That seems like ancient history for us Americans. But in point of fact, it's very real and right on our front doorsteps today. Some of you may have heard of the Jesus Seminar. You guys heard of the Jesus Seminar? I mentioned it last time, but have you seen things in newspapers and magazines? The Jesus Seminar is a group of New Testament scholars who specialize in the study of Jesus, of the historical Jesus, who at one stage got together on a fairly periodic basis to work through the materials of the Gospels and to vote on what they considered to be authentic and what they considered to be inauthentic. They had kind of a modified black ball system. Black indicated that it was not written by Jesus. Gray indicated that we don't think it was written by Jesus, but might have been. Pink indicated like it's fairly probable that it was written by Jesus, but we're not sure. And red said, yeah, this is Jesus. Okay? And principally, they were concerned with the sayings of Jesus, at least initially. But the question goes on to all facets of Jesus' life, at least as it's reported in the Gospels. And they are sorting out the authentic from the unauthentic in their terms. Now, this sounds fairly crass. It certainly sounds very American and somewhat democratic. You get 60 people in a room and you have them vote on whether Jesus said that or not. I mean, it just sounds kind of weird. But if you go to their website, it is very striking that what they were intending to do is take what had discussions that had been going on for 100 years or more in technical New Testament circles, erudite places where people are just publishing to one another and, you know, a hundred people read whatever I publish, you know, that kind of thing. But say that there's this disconnect between what the scholars, in quotes, are saying and what the average person in the pew believes. So they launched a project to narrow that gap. In other words, to bring their scholarship into the pew. Or I would say, to inflict their very minimalist view of Jesus on the people in your churches. Because they're looking for the people in your churches. The people you'll be sitting across from in a counseling session. The people that you'll be sharing the gospel of Christ with when you're just going in your day-to-day ministry. And a measure of their effectiveness is in the number of media events that keep interviewing this same group of guys. I mentioned last time how Newsweek and Time frequently have, almost every year now it seems, right around the time of Easter, come up with another article on the historical Jesus. Especially last year, by the way, coming out of the Passion of Christ, there were a whole host of articles that came out critiquing the movie, first as being very violent and bloody and very Mel Gibson-ish. But then if you read some of the articles in more detail, they were also critiquing the degree of the historical reliability, not just of the movie, and I grant that there's some issues there because he brings in a lot of stuff that's not in the Gospels, but not just of the movie, but also of the Gospels themselves, especially with regard to the trial of Jesus, which I want to get into in a little bit. So it's very much in popular media. For over the last, 3 or 4 years now, there have been two major releases where Peter Jennings, Primetime, ABC, In Search of Jesus, one thing, and then there was another one on Jesus and Paul done about a year later than that. And he interviewed, again, this slate of typical Jesus Seminar people who are highly skeptical of the Gospels and therefore are critiquing the Jesus that you know. Now, the kind of gut reaction for many evangelicals is, well, they're just ignorant. I mean, or it is, I'm going to stand by the Gospels, you know, win, lose, or draw. I'm going to stand by the Gospels because it's the Word of God. And I applaud that. It is the Word of God, and you should stand by the Gospels. But I would submit to you that you are going to be interacting with people and possibly in your family, certainly in your day-to-day ministry and life, to the degree that you are bringing people in from contexts that have been exposed to this media events, that you're going to be dealing with people in your daily life who care about these things and would look to you as a person with a seminary degree to have something to say to them. Okay? That's why I think it's important that you know kind of from the inside what's going on with the historical Jesus and provide a critique that is a responsible intellectual critique instead of a, I'm just going to stand by the Gospels, which is a responsible spiritual critique, but you need an intellectual critique too. All right. That's all by means of introduction. Now, I do want to note that there are some typical terminology that's used. This is often referred to as the quest for the historical Jesus. The term, the quest for the historical Jesus, is associated in some ways with Schweitzer and others. But there's really been called three quests now. People will refer to the three quests for the historical Jesus. In point of fact, there's a very blurred distinction between the kind of the new quest, which is the second quest, and the third quest. And I'll acknowledge that there's points of continuity and such. The first quest goes back to the 18th century when a man named Reimarus, after his death, some of his own ponderings were later published by what was one of the most famous German authors of his day, Lessing. These were known as the Wolfenbüttel Fragments. And in it, Reimarus said that basically, as you see in front of you, Jesus was a Jewish revolutionary who sought to die a martyr's death. His disciples later developed the idea of the resurrection and return of Christ. Now, what is so striking about Reimarus' statement there is that it came to be used, or people have thought like him, for hundreds of years afterwards. Okay, that there's this radical disconnect between Jesus as a historical figure and the people who came after him, especially Paul. Okay. Often people in some circles will speak of Paul as the one who really founded Christianity. Christianity, as you know it, is more indebted to Paul than it is to Jesus. Jesus was much more concerned about overthrowing the Romans, according to Reimarus, and therefore he died a martyr's death. But his disciples then later developed the idea of the resurrection so that they could kind of keep going, if you would, and still venerate Jesus, their leader. There's a number of names that could be associated with this first quest, but the next three are the most typical and the ones you really should know the names of. David Friedrich Strauss and Johannes Weiss. What you see is this move in some ways away from the revolutionary character of Jesus and this sense that he's really trying to overthrow the Romans to something that is much more in keeping with his explicit teachings. So Strauss will say that the Gospels provide a basic outline of Jesus' life, but they also add mythological elements to Jesus' life because of the early church's belief that Jesus was the Messiah. So he's willing to say that the Gospels have a generally good outline, but there's a lot of this extra mythological stuff, much of it associated with the miracles, for instance, that was added later because the church believed that Jesus was such a great guy. Okay. What is striking then about the move from Strauss to Weiss is that Weiss indicates that Jesus was actually talking about an eschatological kingdom. He was, in fact, talking about the incoming, the inbreaking of the kingdom of God that he thought was going to happen any day, and he was preparing people for it to happen. The end of the first quest, in many respects, came about because of Albert Schweitzer, who wrote The Quest for the Historical Jesus, which in some ways is kind of, he retells the history of the whole quest, of the different people who came before him. And then he launches his own notion of what is the appropriate way to speak of Jesus. There's a couple of very striking images that come out of Schweitzer's teaching here. One is the image of a well. And what he says is that the people who have done historical Jesus work up until his time, it was as if they were peering down a well to try and find at the very bottom of the well what Jesus looked like. And as they're peering down the well, they see him. And they say, ah, there he is, and they start to describe him. But in fact, what they are seeing is their own reflection in the water at the bottom of the well. In other words, what he was accusing the people who preceded him, his fellow New Testament scholars, of doing is basically reading into Jesus who they wanted Jesus to be. Okay? This is a very striking critique because all of this is going on during the rise of what is technically known as German liberalism. And when I use the term liberal there, I don't mean it in this kind of quasi-prerogative, pejorative, that's what I'm looking for. This pejorative way that it's used in rhetoric today, you know, people spit out the term liberal and they spit out the term conservative depending on what context you're coming from. This was a technical term for a whole movement in theology known as liberalism. And what it sought to do was to provide a rational basis for Christian religion. And it found in the teachings of Jesus three great propositions to basically paraphrase Adolf von Harnack, his name you don't have to know, but here's the three propositions. Jesus primarily taught about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man and the infinite value of the human soul. Fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man, and the infinite value of the human soul. Now that's a very enlightened way of speaking of Jesus. And when I say that, that comes right out of the Enlightenment. This is exactly what moral people were supposed to believe. That God was the Father of us all, that we are brothers, and that we all have common origins, and that we are valuable because we are worthy of value, basically. And so those were the three great propositions. Well, they saw this in Jesus. And to the extent that Paul taught about the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus as needing to atone for our sins and all of this kind of stuff, that was later. And it wasn't what Christianity was really about from its founder, namely Jesus, what it should have been its founder. All right. So Schweitzer basically says, well, you guys are reading your own German liberalism into what you see in Jesus. But that won't work. Because if you look at the teachings of Jesus and the way that he died, he wasn't some wonderful guy just going around spreading peace and love that happened to run into the Pharisees who weren't in favor of peace and love. There had to be something else going on. So Schweitzer suggests, as I think I put here, that Jesus sought to provoke the eschatological kingdom of God by his ministry and ultimately by his death. Jesus was convinced that God was just about on the verge of bringing in his kingdom here on earth. And that all that it would take is a prophetic ministry announcing it, and then an event that was so traumatic that it would inaugurate, it would start, not using the term inaugurate, it would start, it would compel God to bring in his kingdom. And that event was, if Jesus would just die himself, then God would have to show up. And according to Schweitzer, Jesus, at least in many respects, was wrong. But he said that makes us uncomfortable because that's not our image at the bottom of the well, but it's more accurate, he said, to the teaching of Jesus. Schweitzer's critique of the historical Jesus could, of course, be brought against Schweitzer himself in some respects. He also saw in Jesus what he wanted to make of it, and it was such a shocking critique that people went underground for a while, basically. I mean, it's not wholly accurate. But the interest in the quest for the historical Jesus waned in many sectors of scholarship for a while. So much so that, part of the reason for this is that an existentialist approach to Christian religion came in, especially in the form of Rudolf Bultmann, who said that whatever Jesus was like, that is somewhat irrelevant because we can also speak of the Christ of faith, and that when we believe the Christ of faith, it produces sufficient existential change in us that is fine. Just follow the Christ of faith and don't worry so much about the Jesus of history. Now, I'm oversimplifying, but this is basically the thrust in Rudolf Bultmann's work. And I know Bultmann was a name that is mentioned, I think, one of our earliest lectures. Bultmann had a student named Ernst Käsemann, which, if you want a way to remember his last name, Käse in German is cheese, and Mann is man, so this is cheese man. Which probably has more to do with his some occupation in the lineage of his family. But it is kind of funny, nonetheless, to be called Cheese Man. So Käsemann. And Käsemann was the student of Rudolf Bultmann. Now, let me tell you something about German scholarship. The person that you work under for your doctoral work is known as your Doktorvater, your doctor father, literally, translated into English. And to go against what your Dr. Vater believes would be as if you were to go against your own father. So when Ernst Käsemann said, no, we need to look at who Jesus was, and it matters, and also parted from Bultmann in a few other respects, this was not only shocking in scholarship, and so shocking that it kind of reopened interest in the historical Jesus, but it was also shocking in kind of the German scholarly scene, because here he is breaking with his Dr. Vater. So he suggested that the quest for the historical Jesus was a valid endeavor, is all I really want you to know at this stage. There were a variety of other people associated with the new quest. In many respects, what they managed to do more than anything was just say, we need to keep talking about Jesus. We can't just go with this Christ of faith idea. And James Robinson was the kind of the person who brought that to the English-speaking world and especially to America. The third quest is perhaps most marked by a couple of things. One is an attempt to situate Jesus in his historical environment. There is some debate about what that historical environment should most look like, whether it is effectively Palestine, like the rest of the Mediterranean world, was so influenced by Greco-Roman thought that we need to find some Greco-Roman philosophy that Jesus looked like, in which case he was a cynic, because the cynics were these traveling philosophers. He was a Mediterranean Jewish cynic, a person who shocked people with his teaching and traveled from place to place, having little care for his own possession, but interesting in changing people's philosophical outlook. That's associated with the name Burton Mack. Or the more prevalent background that people find today is that Jesus was, and this may come shock to you, Jewish. Right? He was Jewish, certainly. And so the question is, what did he look like in his Jewish world? And then there's several people that I note there in terms of their Jewish approaches to Jesus. Namely, Geza Vermesh, where Jesus is a Galilean charismatic miracle worker. And that term charismatic miracle worker is to put him in a class of people who claim to be doing miracles in Palestine in the first century. Okay? Or Ben Myers, who indicates that what's most important is Jesus' proclamation. And he's interested in the restoration of Israel, the throwing off of Gentile oppression, but also in the restoring of the spiritual constituency of Israel. Ed Sanders, E.P. Sanders, with his notion that Jesus sought to bring in a new age by invoking the overthrow of the temple. But Ed Sanders is quick to defend the Pharisees as not being as bad as you think they are. And so it's not principally the Pharisees that oppose Jesus. But in seeking to overthrow the temple, he brought out the authorities, especially the aristocracy, against Jesus. Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, which is a name who's perhaps more familiar to some of you, Tom Wright has written both very academic works, and he's also written some very popular-level works, and he's spoken at some conferences, including like Urbana, in the InterVarsity conference and such. And so evangelicals tend to know about him. It's very important in reading Tom Wright, especially to know of his longer works, his more scholarly works, and to realize that he is writing them to kind of secular New Testament scholars. He's not writing them to evangelicals per se. That's his audience is rather to try and convince his peers that the thrust of what the Gospels has to say about who Jesus is accurate. Even in his most recent book, he has defended the resurrection of Jesus, which is a huge shock in secular university New Testament scholarship. So I have a great deal of respect for some of the things he's trying to do, although I wouldn't necessarily agree with him in all of his particulars. But there he says that Jesus announces the restoration of Israel from exile. Israel still thought it was an exile. The Babylonian exile hadn't really ended because they were still under the thumb of foreign nations And so he claims that Israel still felt itself in exile. This is one of, I think, the weakest claims in all of Tom Wright's books, because I think the evidence for Israel still conceiving of itself in exile is very sparse. In any case, he announces the restoration of Israel from exile, the inclusion of the Gentiles, so he wants to bring Gentiles into this new Israel, and the coming judgment. He is put to death for appearing an insurrectionist. He then is resurrected. So there's a kind of a description of that. Now, what I'm interested in for you guys, at least for the exam, is that you know some of these taglines associated with these different names, in part to give you a sense of kind of the movement of how people have talked about Jesus over the last couple hundred years, and so that you also know these names, so if you read them, you're like, oh yeah, he's a historical Jesus guy, oh yeah, and he believed that Jesus was a revolutionary. And if that, you know that much, then you can start to enter into some of this literature and understand some of the things that are informing people today. Okay, before we move into the question of criteria, are there any questions? Well, there's a lot of complex things that were going on in Germany in the day. Part of it is this notion of Reformation coming out of Martin Luther and some of the extreme teachings that became associated with kind of scholastic Lutheranism that put off some people, but also created categories of thinking about, for instance, the relationship to the law and things like that. And so there's some stuff within the church. There was movements in broader scholarly society, a movement towards Hegelianism and towards rational thought being supreme above all. So you have Kant writing about enlightenment and people after him understanding the life of the mind and mind being kind of the arbitrator of truth. So that Kant is even able, although this isn't the whole of his religious system, but to write a book entitled Religion Within the Bounds of Reason Alone. You know? And so reason becomes the arbiter of all truth. So you had philosophical principles going on like that. And then you had the rise of kind of a de facto German liberalism that held to the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the infinite value of the human soul, all of which are very lovely thoughts. What's missing there, perhaps, is, I don't know, sin, judgment, punishment, you know, the need for a sacrifice, the gospel, you know, all of that. But that's some of what's going on in that context. And Germany was the hotbed of this. You'll realize that a lot of these names are basically German names. Basically, in the 19th century and into the 20th century, the movers and shakers within New Testament scholarship were coming out of Germany in general. There was a shift in some ways at the beginning of the 20th century to British scholarship coming on, receiving the same kind of respect as German scholarship. And as the 20th century progressed, Americans came into play too. Not always for good, by the way. Don't just think Americans are going to save the day. We made things worse in some respects. But there's whole cultural movements going on. It's a good question, Ben. Okay. The question of criteria. One of the things that is really a benefit coming out of the new and the third quest is the scholars, and there's a lot of scholars involved in Jesus scholarship, by the way. I should tell you that there's at least a half dozen books coming out on Jesus every year from this kind of perspective, from trying to work out who the historical Jesus is. Some of them are basically happy to use the Gospels as very important source material and therefore respect the Gospels. Some almost completely reject the Gospels and say we can't vouchsafe almost any of that stuff. So you have extremes going on there. But there's all these books coming out on Jesus, and it is basically impossible to keep up with all the literature that's coming out now. So I've chosen, instead of trying to give you jillions of names, which I'm sure you would have wanted to memorize, to just kind of point out some of the main figures. And if you understand these names, they're the ones that keep coming back into the discourse. Anyway, one of the benefits that has come out of the new quest and the third quest is the sense of we need to come up with what our criteria was. Schweitzer was correct. Too often people come to this stuff and they come down and they just read into Jesus who they want Jesus to be. We need to come up with some criteria that's more objective in order to be able to sort out what Jesus really did and what he really didn't do. Okay. What the list of criteria can vary from just a handful, three or four criteria, to sometimes dozens or more of criteria that are employed. But there's some criteria. I keep using the same word, but there's some of these criteria that are agreed by pretty much everybody who's doing the work in historical Jesus work. And I want to let you know what some of that is. So by criteria, I mean means of thinking about, say, a saying of Jesus in the Gospels to determine whether he said it or not. As soon as I state that, you realize that we're in a fairly skeptical enterprise. You can't treat the Gospels as if everything they say is true. So you need some criteria to judge what of it really goes back to Jesus and what of it's just later in the history of the church that was read into Jesus. Okay? So here are the five criteria. The first is dissimilarity with Judaism and with the early church. Now, what I want to do is show to you that if you are thinking of the Gospels in a very skeptical fashion, these are five interesting ways of trying to determine what is accurate and what's not. The first is this dissimilarity with Judaism and Christianity. The fear in approaching the Gospels is that the Gospels come out of Christian circles a few decades after Jesus, and by that point, the traditions have changed more to the needs of the church than to what Jesus was really like. Okay? If that's the case, then, what you're really afraid is that people are reading later Christianity back onto Jesus. So to the extent that there's stuff that's said in the Gospels that shocks you and would make you uncomfortable as a Christian and would have made them uncomfortable in the first century, well, that's got to go back to Jesus because the Christian church wouldn't have come up with that on their own. That goes back to Jesus. So shocking things that are dissimilar with later Christianity, that likely goes back to Jesus. And then likewise, the degree to which Jesus said and did stuff that was not typically what a Jewish person would do would make him stand out from the crowd, and to the degree that it's dissimilar both from Christianity and for Judaism, you respect it all the more because you think this isn't just a cultural thing that was read into Jesus. This is something he really did. That's the first criteria, the criteria of dissimilarity. The second criteria is consistency with other material known to be authentic, generally by criteria number one. Criteria number one is admitted to be fairly minimalistic. Only the stuff that really stands out as separate from what the church believed can we accept. However, we might be able to sneak in other aspects and sayings of Jesus that are found in the Gospels if we see that they agree with or follow the same line of teaching in the material that we know to be authentic because it's so different from Christian teaching, later Christian teaching. So you establish kind of a minimalistic thing in criteria one, and then you can add further stuff to it insofar as it coheres with that minimal accepted nature of who Jesus is. That's criteria number two. Number three, multiple attestation in many levels of tradition. Now here we are saying that basically if something shows up in a whole lot of accounts of Jesus from a variety of different sources, then the possibility of it being accurate is increased. Unfortunately, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are thought to be largely dependent on one another, Matthew and Luke, especially on Mark. So therefore, they're not independent witnesses. But if you get Matthew, Mark, and Luke on one hand, and maybe the Gospel of John on another, and if there's some other tradition we could find that also attests life and teachings of Jesus, and it all says the same thing, well, then that's good. Well, what else do we have that's potentially early that accounts the sayings of Jesus? Well, this is where the Gospel of Thomas comes in, which is a Gnostic gospel that's associated with Thomas the Apostle. It was not written by him. But is basically a collection of sayings of Jesus or that are attributed to Jesus. Some of them are clearly Gnostic and therefore second century, I would argue. But some of them very much parallel the sayings that you find in the canonical Gospels, especially in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So this criteria of multiple attestation basically comes down in kind of modern practice to, if it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in the Gospel of Thomas, then it's likely to be the case. All right? So that's the third one. The fourth set of tests involves whether the sayings appear to be Aramaic-based. That is, they have a Semitic language feel to it. Jesus probably spoke Aramaic and not Greek. The Gospels are in Greek. But the degree to which you find terminology that Jesus uses that is Aramaic and therefore has to be translated, or Aramaic patterns of speech that are crudely translated into Greek, then that's more likely to go back to a native Aramaic speaker and then potentially to Jesus. So that's criteria number four. And finally, criteria number five involves cultural tests whether the material could be attributed to a Palestinian Jewish person. This is especially associated with the third quest for Jesus. You notice that I mentioned at least four different guys in the third quest for Jesus that want to see Jesus as Jewish. So they would say the degree to which Jesus is acting like your plain old average everyday Palestinian Jewish person, that's likely to be authentic because the church very quickly went Gentile, and so the stuff that goes back to a Jewish Jesus is likely to be more authentic. So those are the five criteria that are typically used to sort out that which is true from that which is false in your Gospels. Okay? Question for you, and I'm interested in your interaction with the materials now. What do you think? Are these good criteria? Do you think they'll produce verifiable results? Do you think that this will lead to a good accounting of who Jesus really was? So the question with number second, if you're trying to be consistent with what's known to be authentic. Well, again, this goes back to, it basically comes back, yeah, to
that's
authentic because it's found to be in multiple attestation and hence in the Gospel of Thomas. And then also that criteria number one, if it meets the kind of dissimilarity criteria, this isn't what a Christian would have said, but it, therefore it must have been what Jesus said. That's authentic stuff, and you can get stuff to stick to that, cohere to it, you know, then you can expand your area of knowledge. Does that bother you, Charlie?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Why? Yeah, so your concern there, just so that everybody heard, is to say that this strikes you as if they're immediately judging the Gospels as being inauthentic, but they're willing to bring in other material as seeming more authentic just because it's not written by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Yeah, good. Other points that people would raise? Yeah. Right. So the point is that criteria 1 and 5 seem to be in conflict with one another to the degree to which he is supposed to be dissimilar from Judaism, and yet criteria number 5 is to the degree to which he's the same as Judaism. And so what you see there is a tension among modern Jesus scholars as to the degree to which we expect a Jewish Jesus and the degree to which we expect him not to be. And they are contradictory, and you're right. Well, it's both and. The question is, do the scholars disagree on these points or do the scholars use both of these criteria? There is disagreement to the degree to which you expect a Jewish Jesus. So therefore you have some people, again like Burton Mack, who's willing to see him as much more Hellenized than he is Jewish in some respects. On the other hand, people have this sense that, you know, he was Jewish, so therefore he should be like Jewish, but at the same time there's this skepticism of the very Jewish passages that are there. So they're at odds with one another, and it leads to the ability of somebody to pick out the stuff that they want to be authentic and say it's authentic because it's Jewish, and then to look at the other material that they don't want to be authentic and say it can't be authentic. Why? Because it's Jewish. You know, it becomes a lot more subjective endeavor. It assumes that the early church changed things. That's right. And that if it's Christian, it must have been changed. That's right. Does that bother you, Nathan?
It doesn't fit there. There's no, where's the proof of that?
Where's the proof of that, is the question. That's basically the assumption, is that if it's orally passed down, then it must have been changed. Yeah. And I mean, not all of it in all of its respects, but it leads to so much change that you can't trust it anymore. On the other hand, can we just say, just for half a second, let's say that I am Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and I've followed for anywhere from a year to 3 years Jesus, and I've listened to everything the man has said, and I consider him to be the Messiah, and I believe him to be crucified and resurrected. Would I not try to be somewhat faithful to what he taught? Would I not be so marked by that year or so that the things that I believe that make for my theology go back to Jesus? I mean, this idea that the Christian church got it wrong inherently just because it's the Christian church, and therefore the areas that Jesus taught something that's different than what the Christian church taught, I mean, that's just balderdash. I mean, I would hope, for instance, that you guys leave here. Now, you're not going to remember everything that we ever say in this class, but I would hope that you would leave here with a few notions from what this class is, and you wouldn't want to say what's authentically Chapman is the stuff that disagrees with what you actually believe. I hope to change some of your beliefs. Certainly Jesus hoped for the same. Yeah. Okay, go ahead, and then we'll go back there. Presuppositions is very highly presupposition-laden, and you mentioned two things, that the canon should be reopened and that the deity of Christ isn't true. That, you're right. And then I would add a third thing, which is that miracles are not true. Miracles don't happen. That's a presupposition, and it's one that may be supported or may not be, but it's a major presupposition coming into this. One last point, yeah. Okay, the question is egos, the degree to which this egos comes in, and they're trying to say something new. Well, you're certainly right. I mean, there is a sense in which it's not just that they're trying to say something new, but that the names that are remembered, I mean, the big names that I mentioned there all said something new, and that's why they're remembered. If you say something that a dozen people have said before you, then you don't stand out. So you become remembered if you say something new. I think it is also fair to say that we could want to critique people because it's their pride that's getting in the way. Well, that could certainly be true, but it's not a fair intellectual critique of what they're trying to say. I think we have to interact with people, well, respectfully in this respect, you know, in this regard. Let me say that as you think about these matters, I'm interested in you mulling over the degree to which this criteria is reasonable. I certainly agree with the critiques that have been made. I think it's very presupposition laden. There are points of disagreement between some of the criteria. They fight against one another. It is the case, largely, that what has happened de facto is the Gospel of Thomas has become a canonical gospel. Because if you can find it in the Gospel of Thomas and it's in the other Gospels, that's Jesus. And so effectively, it's a backdoor way of bringing the Gospel of Thomas in. That's not saying that they view the whole of the Gospel of Thomas as accurately Jesus. That would be an overstatement. But if it's in the Gospel of Thomas, bah, we're there. This has got to be Jesus. And that is, I don't think, reasonable, in part because I will argue ultimately that the Gospel of Thomas is a second century work that is, to the extent that it represents the Gospels, it's derivative from the Gospels, and that to the extent that it changes the traditions of the Gospels, it tends to do so in a very Gnosticizing direction. In other words, it changes it, Jesus' teaching towards a second century heresy. So that's what I would argue ultimately about the Gospel of Thomas. The central criteria, really, if you were to just have one, the one that everybody lives and dies by, it's this first one, the dissimilarity with Judaism in the early church. And to me, that's extremely skeptical because it just assumes that Jesus was not a good enough teacher that he would have influenced and changed the people who followed him, such that their beliefs were molded and shaped by him, and therefore, when they believe something, it might very well be because Jesus taught it. It's just extremely skeptical. The reason I mention all of this is that very rarely, especially in the Newsweek and the Time, you know, articles, do the people mention why they say something's authentic and why it's not? But they're running with these kind of presuppositions. And I think the probably the most powerful critique of much of historical Jesus scholarship has more to do with the presuppositions that people bring to bear than it does to the specific results of do we accept this matter or that matter, etc. Let me also mention in this regard that there's a scholar named Gerd Ludemann, who is another German scholar who's on the Jesus Seminar. He flies over every so often to the U.S. to be on the Jesus Seminar. One of the things I appreciate about Ludemann is he is a very skeptical New Testament scholar, but he admits it. He's just very overt about, these are my presuppositions, this is what I'm holding to be the case, and this is why I accept something to be authentic and not authentic. Whereas many of the other scholars are much more, they play a much more dodgy game of not coming out and overtly stating why they're going to throw out stuff as being authentic or inauthentic. And he has a section in his book which is called The Great Deception and What Jesus Really Said and Did, where he talks about the presuppositions of his work, and he actually gives his criteria for not just authenticity, but for inauthenticity. And most scholars are not willing to say what their criteria for inauthenticity is. It's much more muted. They simply just reject something, and they don't tell you why they're rejecting it. Well, he gives four propositions. First, those sayings and actions are clearly inauthentic in which the exalted Lord speaks and acts or is presupposed as the one who speaks and acts. Why? For Jesus himself no longer spoke and acted after his death. But as we cannot exclude the possibility that words or actions of the historical Jesus have been attributed to the risen Christ, in quotes, for the early Christians, the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith were identical. Each time we must check whether particular sayings of the exalted Christ are not perhaps based on a saying of the early Jesus, the earthly Jesus. In other words, Jesus did not raise from the dead. Ludemann's actually written a book to that effect, and in the process basically lost a lot of his respect among German university scholars. And the reason was, It was okay if you believe that. Most German university scholars do believe that the resurrection didn't happen. But you can never say it, because the German university is the training ground for the German state church, which is the whole Lutheran church in Germany. And for somebody to come out and just say, I don't believe in the resurrection, and then to admit, as Ludemann does, that means I am not a Christian because Christians believe in the resurrection, was so shocking that he got excluded from some of his scholarly endeavors. That's one of the reasons I respect him, honestly. Admit where you're coming from and just be overt about it, and I respect that. Anyway, so his point is, Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, so any sayings that are attributed to a risen Jesus couldn't come from the real Jesus. Right? Secondly, those acts are unhistorical which presuppose that natural laws are broken. Here the fact that people in the time of Jesus did not know these laws or did not think in scientific categories is irrelevant. They were stupid, if you would, and miracles don't happen. So anything that's a miracle, you throw out. I've mentioned that before, but there it's very overt. Thirdly, a suspicion of inauthenticity attaches to all the sayings of Jesus if they give answers to community situations in a later time. So if a saying of Jesus gives answer to a dilemma that shows up in later Christianity, well, that's coming from later Christianity and not from Jesus. We just know it's not his, so we can just rule that out a priori. Fourthly, those sayings and actions are inauthentic, which presuppose a Gentile and not a Jewish audience. For it is certain, he says, it is certain that Jesus was active exclusively in the Jewish sphere. That Syrophoenician woman that asked for Jesus to heal him, Jesus wouldn't have done that. He worked only among Jewish people. Okay? Ruled out a priori. And then he also states his criteria of authenticity, most of which overlap with the 5 points that I just made there. All right? So that gives you a sense of the presuppositions that go into this. Strengths and weaknesses. Strengths. Well, there are some strengths. I mean, we really do want to know what Jesus was like, and the Gospels only give us a particular slice of his life, and there's probably more to say. One of the things that I appreciate about F.F. Bruce, for instance, is that he correlates aspects of the Gospels and their narrative of the life of Jesus with other historical material that fills in the context in which Jesus lived and walked. And so I don't want to say that this idea of trying to find out who Jesus was is wholly out to lunch. On the other hand, in terms of weaknesses, it is very presuppositional-laden. And they will come to you and they will say something like, you just don't believe, or you just believe the Gospels, and that's just naive. Well, your response is, yeah, I've got my presuppositions, but you've got a few too, and let's look at yours. Okay? And that's a response I would make. All right? Now, again, there are evangelicals who work, and I think it's a very difficult context to work in, because most of the people that you're speaking to are very skeptical of the Gospels. And so somebody like Tom Wright comes in there, or Scott McKnight, and they are trying, basically, to show that Jesus was who the Gospels say he is, and still play on the playing field of this very skeptical criteria. In some ways, I'm not even willing to go into that playing field, because the playing field itself is very uneven. I mean, you're playing a football game, and the other team gets the top of the hill, and you're at the bottom. And your job's to get to the goal up there, and all they have to do is just roll down the hill with this criteria. I mean, it's a very uneven playing field, I think. So anyway, some comments there. Any last questions before we leave this? I still have left 5 minutes to talk about the trial of Jesus. So yeah.
Just quickly, does criteria one, are they saying that there's no possibility of continuity? I mean, if it shows up later, that denies it.
They won't say that there's no possibility, but they'll say that we start off with the stuff that is clearly not in league with the stuff that comes later. And then any of the stuff that's later that we consider to be authentic, we consider it authentic based on that second criteria, or possibly the multiple attestation thing. But that second criteria allows us to bring in some of the other stuff that Jesus said that was picked up later in the early church, as long as it's like the kind of radical stuff that Jesus taught himself. Here, let me give you an example, as long as I've got Ludemann here. First, many sayings and actions of Jesus might prove, this is his criteria of authenticity, might prove to be authentic by virtue of the criteria of offensiveness, he says. That's our criteria of dissimilarity. For example, among Jesus' actions, his decision to be baptized by John belongs here. From very earliest times, the baptism of Jesus was offensive to Christians. I mean, why is it that this forerunner of Jesus actually has this authority over Jesus to baptize? So that was offensive to Christians. And from the beginning, it was changed in various ways, he argues. He doesn't tell you how. He just argues that it was. Or passed over completely in silence or rejected by Jesus, quote unquote, Jesus in the gospel himself. So therefore, he's willing to take that baptism of Jesus as authentic. Okay? And then to the degree to which you can find stuff that coheres with that baptism narrative, well, that can be authentic as well. And you can bring in other stuff through the back door. So that's how it works. If you want to read more, there's this one chapter that's maybe 15 pages in Ludemann, and it's very helpful to get you a feel for what he's interested in. All right. Trial of Jesus. I think we can do this in 3 or 4 minutes. This is going to happen. Coming out of the Passion of Christ movie from last year, again, I mentioned that there were a number of articles about not just why the Passion, the movie, got things historically wrong, but why the Gospels as well are wrong. So if you go back and read some of the Newsweek articles, and if you go back and see some of the television interviews and that kind of stuff, you'll see that the Gospels themselves were challenged in terms of, because see, Mel Gibson said, well, I accept the Gospels as authentic and I'm going to follow that as source material. And so people said, no, you can't do that. And that's some of the stuff that you see even in the popular press. And especially the issues that revolve around Jesus' trial. So, for instance, Pontius Pilate is treated in the Gospels and also in the Passion movie as somebody who really doesn't want to see Jesus go to the cross. He sees somebody who's innocent, and he doesn't want to send an innocent person to the cross. Well, if you read the narratives in Josephus and Philo about Pontius Pilate, I mean, the guy is just an absolute cur. He is the biggest cad this world has ever seen. The guy doesn't give a whip about what Jewish people think, brings in offensive religious materials into the heart of Jerusalem, and almost starts revolt after revolt after revolt in the 10 years that he's procurator, or prefect over Jerusalem. And in the process, alienates the Jewish people. It's like he doesn't care. And then you get to the Gospels, and he's this kind of Gentile leader standing up for Jesus. And the accusation is that what's going on in the Gospels there is, in order to make the religion of Jesus more palatable in the Roman world, the Gospel authors play down the aspects of Roman participation in the crucifixion of Jesus, make the Jewish people responsible for all that, and especially Pontius Pilate as the governor wants to stand by Jesus. You see how that made it sound better? So that's the claim that's made against the gospel narrative there. And other aspects of the claims that are made against the gospel narrative include things such as, there are some passages, I think I might have cited one on our discussion of crucifixion, which indicate that the Jewish rabbis believed that crucifixion was not something they should participate in. It's not what is taught in Deuteronomy 21. They don't practice suspension as the Roman leader, the Roman people do. Do you remember? Did I have that up? Did I have the C-Frey Deuteronomy quote up? I think I may have. Therefore, if you take that as your starting point, then it is impossible for the Jewish leaders to have wanted Jesus to be crucified, let alone for the crowds to be standing outside going, crucify him, crucify him. Because they didn't believe crucifixion was acceptable. Okay? So you see then, and I list there five charges against the gospel accounts there. And I've hit on a few of these in respect there. Those are the five major issues with the trial accounts. And I use this as an example of, again, historical Jesus scholarship, because basically what you're doing is you're using other sources, Jewish rabbinic teaching, or your own logic in terms of how these things would have been received in the Roman world, and so playing down Roman participation in the crucifixion of Jesus would have been a good thing. So you use your own logic, your own presuppositions, and other materials to critique whether the Gospels are accurate or not. Then what I've done in your handout there is to give short responses to each of the charges in order. Okay? So just to take the first one as an example, the question as to whether the Sanhedrin was capable of capital punishment. Some say that they were capable of capital punishment, so it would not have had to deliver Jesus to the Romans. Well, in terms of responses, first of all, the Sanhedrin apparently lost the right of capital punishment just prior to Jesus' death. Talmud actually mentions that 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin lost the right of capital punishment. So you have that. That's one, point one. One might come back and say, oh, but wasn't Stephen stoned? But the example of Stephen being stoned represents a populist stoning without the completion of the trial. There was no actual complete trial. There was not an official judicial verdict. People just started picking up stones and letting them have it. And other examples that we have from Acts or from Josephus also indicate that there were specific extenuating circumstances with regard to the right of capital punishment there. So there's a quick response to point number one. For your exam on Friday, the way I would think of each of these points is, can I can I think of how Dr. Chapman, you know, in these short responses, what two or three main points he makes in rebuttal? You don't have to memorize the Talmudic texts or anything like that that I use as supporting evidence, but just what are the two or three things that I would say in response to the charges against the gospel accounts? Okay? So that's how I want you to use this material. So read it on your own. I think you'll find it sufficient to give you some sense of how you would respond. The item that I handed out while the tape was being changed, we didn't get to on the Passion Predictions or the Lord's Supper, so please bring that next Wednesday, and we'll deal with the intention of Jesus on next Wednesday and how this material is relevant to that.